This is Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintzenmeyer. On episode 12, I'll be talking to John Philip Chanel, a keyboardist and composer, but most of his career has been spent as a producer and arranger. Right now you're listening to Phil's string arrangement from the end of Yes, Anastasia from Tori Amos's 1994 album Under the Pink. He's worked with Tori for many years, has worked with The Bangles, Jane's Addiction, Tracy Chapman, many others. He's done soundtrack work, like we hear about his work on Sons of Anarchy. The songs we're going to delve into in this episode are first Cross the Channel by Brick and Chanel from the 2012 self-titled EP, then The Stars That Speak, a track he produced and arranged for Willie DeVille from Willie's last album Pistola in 2008, before he passed away. And then we're going to reach back to 1990 to an electronic fusion recording project that Phil initiated called The Royal Macadamians. The album was Experiments in Terror, and the song is called Porno Kiss. And finally, we'll leave you with a brand new composition called Gautama in Love. To learn more about Phil's work, check out johnphilipchanel.com. To learn more about this podcast, check out nakedlyexaminedmusic.com.
I'm here with John Philip Chanel. Hi, Phil.
How you doing, man? Good to see you this morning.
It's great to see you. Thanks for doing this. Folks just heard a little bit of the Tori Amos's Anastasia, your main gig. So let me just get this straight. So starting in the 70s, you were doing just keyboard on people's stuff, and then you gradually started doing more arranging and adding strings and then adding whole production to your repertoire. Is that right?
Basically, I started as a classically oriented composer in the 60s. Eventually, I got hip to people like the Yardbirds and Jimi Hendrix, and that kind of expanded my space. Played live mostly during the 70s, you know, traditional rock bands.
That's when you were doing stuff with the Beach Boys some of the time?
Yes, Beach Boys and a couple of fusion bands and a couple of local bands. And did some recording, but it wasn't until the late 70s when I started getting seriously into recording. And over that time in the 70s, I'd started doing more arranging. As a keyboard player, you kind of end up being the guy who does that. And I loved it, and I pursued it, or learning about strings, half self-taught, half traditionally trained in taking music classes and things.
So you'd done the whole orchestration classes as part of your composition degree, or was that?
Well, I started off in physics, and then I shift my major to music, which in the end turned out to be quite a good match, you know, just in terms of my own personal thing. I don't think it was ever wasted. Science is still part of my life, even in music. But the answer to your question is basically, I'm half self-taught and half educated in traditional school. So, you know, I studied, you know, Schoenberg and his theory and Henry Schenker. And along with playing in rock and roll bands, I kind of put together something that is my take on it, at least.
I saw on your blogger user profile, you were listing your favorite music, and you had Schoenberg down there. But Schoenberg, only pre-World War One. You had to specify, is he got too atonal after that, or what? I forget exactly what the...
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting with him because, I mean, he's kind of like the penultimate development from Brahms, Mahler, Schoenberg, you know, in terms of the development of melody, the expansion of melody.
Uh-huh. Before it got reduced to John Cage, before it got reduced to chaos.
But here's the thing, you know, I hated it. I hated 12 tone until I realized, well, wait a minute. It's a way of freeing your mind. It may not necessarily make music, but as a tool to uncover other things, not such a bad idea because, I mean, hey, who knows? 12 tone music or having a couple of drinks. Whatever loosens you up to thinking in terms of new perception, I think is good. Taken to an extreme, not so good.
Once you've perceived, once you've expressed something that the whole point of it is to be something that you can't make sense of, that it's so freeing, then, well, okay, I've done that. Now I can actually try to go back and express something. Yeah. I was in composition school and a little bit in college as well. That was sort of a minor that I flirted with. And the way I thought about the more complicated tonal music there was when your music, it's like you're trying to say something. It's like you're trying to make a sentence. And if you were just writing a poem or something and using the same sentences other people have made, why would you possibly want to do that?
Right.
So, you know, having this expanded vocabulary so you can actually say something unique. And then even if you're going to keep yourself to, okay, I'm only going to use words in English. Let's just say that that's the analogy for traditional tonal Western structures,
yeah.
Then still, this is a good way to segue to our first song here, Cross the Channel by Brick and Chenail. The Captain and Tennille, I was there. No.
There is no captain in that duo. There is no captain. There are two captains, actually, I guess.
You know, there's nothing tonally wacky going on here, but it's very deliberate in terms of the note choices from measure to measure, that it's not like you just turned on a loop and let it go. I really like the development of this nice little, could be very movie soundtrack riff. You've done a lot of movie soundtrack stuff, right?
Sure. The idea of cinema is actually a baseline that I work from because it has been that way with me. I mean, music has always been vision to me, not, I mean, that's a thing that made me cry when I was 5 years old and listened to classical music that my parents would be playing. I mean, that's kind of what I go back to constantly. It's my blood. So everything that I've done is basically trying to do that in one way or another. In fact, if I have to busk a project because I don't particularly like it, I'll make up a vision and create some kind of integrity, you know, some kind of wholeness to it that binds everything together. In this case, Cross the Channel, obviously from the title, what we're talking about, but we're also talking about humans. We're talking about the allusion to people coming together, the channel in particular separating England and France. That's the imagery. That's not necessarily expressed explicitly in it, but that kind of imagery is what is, I think, part of most music. I think it's rarely intellectual, except maybe back to the Schoenberg 12-tone. I mean, it's interesting thinking about that when you think about Stravinsky, as evocative as he is. I mean, you listen to Alexander Nevsky, and you're going, you see, well, in that case, that was a film, or anything, any of his other programmatic tonal pieces. Stravinsky was a big one to say, I mean, he said, I don't know what his exact quote was, but something like as if this music is not about emotions or something to that effect. It was like, what a contrary idea. I mean, when you listen to his music, it's filled with imagery and filled with emotion and filled with, you know, our human stuff that most artists write about. I mean, in Schoenberg's case, of course, it was mathematics. But I think a vision, feeling, visions are all part of it. And that's definitely what Across the Channel was. It started there. It didn't even start Across the Channel. It started with a session one night after some big, massive day of orchestration with a 60-piece orchestra or whatever. It was something like that, that I had to get away from it. And this came to my head. And I worked on it till 6 o'clock in the morning because it was there. I needed to get that done. And about a year later, Addie and I started talking about doing our project together just for fun. There was no there was no outcome from this. I would be in London, you know, she lived in Hampstead at the time, and I would go there and we'd hang out for a week and we'd write and enjoy our discussions and life and all of that. So this EP came out of those experiences. Whatever came to our consciousness, we wrote about. Much of it was written in Los Angeles in terms of the music goes. And then I would send her the music and she would pick and choose things that she wanted to work on. And this was one of them. And this was actually the first one we worked on together. Thank you.
While the wind remains from a northerly point, it will stay cold. There may be an Atlantic influence at the end of the week to bring the very cold theme to an end. While the wind remains from a northerly point, it will stay cold. But there may be an Atlantic influence at the end of the week to bring the very cold theme to an end. While the wind remains from a northerly point.
The way you had sent this to me was with a video with is it the Chamondeleys?
Chamondeleys.
Some sort of circus dance troupe. I didn't look up what else they've done here. You were saying this is, you know, you like imagery to go with this, and we'll point folks at the video, which is a pretty bizarre, lots of paper mache costumes and people dancing around rhythmically. Just
Addie would take me to some of the oddest places in London to see music and performance art and stuff. I mean, literally one night she took me to a place, a bar in London that was playing John Cage. And here's a bunch of blokes and girlfriends and whoever, couples, drinking beer in a London pub and
yelling, 3 minutes of silence. Play 3 minutes of silence.
Oh, no, sorry, no. It was the opposite of silence. It was a record player and the guy was scratching the record. I forgot which piece of poetry it was by John Cage, but literally everybody's, you know, with their hand on their chin, like analyzing what's going down. And I'm going, this is like awful. And I don't know. I haven't got it. Whatever. But the thing is, so she took me to a bar that the Chamondeleys were performing at, and there was a very modernistic combo, literally, you know, bass, drums, keyboard, normal setup, but they were playing like very dissonant music. And we were looking at them, and we were saying, you know what, this rhythm that they had set up would match our song across the channel. And then this, oh God, I can't remember who edited it, a very great editor put this thing together.
Okay.
And it was definitely after the fact. We didn't compose to the piece, but with some brilliant editing and with some natural rhythm that they provided, it seemed to be a good match.
So you said you had this as an instrumental for a while first. This deliberate composition that I was referring to is, you know, I would picture a lot of people writing, first of all, was it written with a loop or you actually played the electric piano through the whole thing? How do you?
Oh, no. I played. It's all played. And it's all transformed. So that's an interesting thing to bring up because there is a general pattern, but it expands and modifies as time goes on because it's a directed thing. It's not transformed through mathematics. It's transformed by performance. And then once that was laid down, then I proceeded to orchestrate that piece. Once Addie started putting the lyrics together, then I started editing that.
Okay, that was the question, because it's very deliberate in terms of, it's basically in 8-measure sections. And each time you do this, you add a new thing or you transform the drum somehow or the vocals. But then the vocals, it definitely doesn't sound like, okay, now you were completely done with the arrangement and then the vocals got added, because what gets added could be a little vocal thing, or it could be like, it seems very well balanced. It doesn't sound after the fact, even though I knew that, you know, you are responsible for the entirety of the synth bed here and that she was coming down with the melody and lyrics. Very sort of Kate Bush sound as far as the voice goes. So Addie Brick, what is her background? I had not previously heard of her. How did you get involved with this?
I worked with Andy Gill from Gang of Four.
Yeah.
Back in, I guess it was, must have been 89, 90, somewhere in there. And she came to the session. She was really intriguing. I mean, we talked about a lot of stuff and music and otherwise. And so we just became friends and I started working with her. We started writing together. We've written a couple of other things over the years, but she's had about 5 or 6 indie records out, done some touring. The last record she did before this was based with Hungarian musicians. She lived in Hungary for 2 or 3 months recording her music with Hungarian musicians. She's quite an eclectic and artistic person. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of her background.
Zooming in on the music here, I mean, you've got a very circular sort of riff, that it's just the 1, the 5, and then the relative minor of the 1 that you stay on for 2 measures.
Right.
So like that's the thing, which is the beginning of Pachelbel's Canon, which was my favorite song when I was 5 years old. Seriously, it was like my first favorite song.
It's definitely a good one. I love it.
And the relative minor just pushes you back to the 1, to the tonic. So you could just pretty much do that forever as far as, so how do you know where to stop? I mean, you have this build for a little while and then you have it drop out after a couple minutes and have this, well, what ended up spoken word, but you know, a bridge that's a completely different progression. And then you go back to the original part.
We like to call that section the weather report.
Was that part of the original intent, or was it just, we got to have something to break this up?
Well, no, I mean, it was lyric driven. I mean, when you talk about how the song seems to be balanced between the two performers. And I mean, that's a very intentional thing in order to make sure that there's an interactive process in the writing and in the composition. So it's not my composition anymore. It's our composition, because everything is coherent with each other. The lyric and melody and the music is all malleable. Thank God. I mean, you know, in the old days when people wanted to use various parts of other tracks and songs and stuff like that, there was hell. I walked into a studio, a Crystal studio, when they were cutting War. Mm-hmm. Remember War, Eric Burton's band, and then they had their own hits. I saw 200 2-inch tapes at the back wall. 200! I talked to my friend who worked there. I said, Jeff, what's the deal with these 200 tapes? I thought they were cleaning out their archives in the studio. And he said, no, this is one record. And so I asked him, well, what are they out here for? Well, we're editing them. They were cutting jams by War to make these songs. Now, the reason this is pertinent is because that's why War sounded both concise and loose at the same time. This is kind of the philosophy of this song and some, and a lot of other things that I've done. The idea to use technology in order to create something which both has life and spontaneity, but also is contoured to create specific events. In other words, there's a certain amount of randomness, there's a certain amount of control. And to balance those things, I mean, I guess this would be a good example of that kind of concept.
So you say she recorded some of her stuff just on her own and sent parts to you, and you were putting these together?
And then when I came to London, she recorded more stuff.
Mm-hmm. So she recorded just a little, or, you know, something. Like, is that the kind of thing that, you know, she had the idea of where that would go in, or you were just like, oh, this would be a good place to put that little stereo thing in here?
It could work equally in both ways. I could decide, she could decide. Sometimes she knew exactly where she wanted it to go. And sometimes we created a space for it to go. So it's very malleable.
I mean, so it seems to be, it is the vocal phrasing that sort of drives how long it's going to go before it has to get to that bridge. You've spent the first few sections sort of building up, adding your little fake drums. I love your fake drums. I love the that you're basically doing, I mean, it's a swing tune. It's a fast little swing thing, but that you're doing basically a backbeat, but there's no real drum sounds in it, that it's all tuned percussion, that you can be precise in terms of what the thing that is acting at the snare right now, is that a
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting is that is an artifact of when you utilize a sample, keeping its time, but changing its pitch.
Mm.
So I loved it because, you know, part of this project with Addy is to break some traditional concepts. In this case, the traditional concept of what a drum kit is and what rhythm is. So in a way, it's great because it doesn't stay in one place. The drum kit is constantly changing in its spectral position in the track. Usually you're trying to keep it stable, but in this case, it's constantly rotating. So I like that you appreciate that aspect of it.
Well, and so much of this, you know, it sounds cool. Like you're very used to arranging string parts. And so you've got your main electric piano riff, and then you've got basically a string orchestra that is coming behind it and playing the cello that, well, it almost sounds like a bassoon, but that's the synth.
Right.
It's the cello part that you picked.
Right. Yeah.
And it pretty much stays in those places, but then can stretch or so that what sound, you know, started as the solo cello that is the main counterpoint to the electric piano part, by the end, it's fattened into a chord. It does that pretty quickly. And you know, the fact that when you start off the song by adding these things one by one and that you end the song more or less the same way, although it's not the electric piano that remains as you would expect, it's this chordal thing that
deconstructed, the orchestration is deconstructed at the end and continues to get deconstructed until it's just a little pipsqueak of an orchestration. By the way, that cello is actually, now that I'm thinking of it, is a Chamberlain cello. It's not a synth. It's a sample of my Chamberlain.
Okay.
Because my Chamberlain is in bad shape. So I knew it well enough to sample it about a decade ago. So I am using samples, but they're actually particular to this instrument.
Yeah, so some of the other sounds like that bum bum bum, that thing that comes in every once in a while, that I was thinking synth brass, but it actually sounds more like one of the tones on a typical organ. Is that also a sampled?
Oh, that's, I think that's my Farfisa.
Okay.
Well, with effects, with some effects, but I think that's a Farfisa, yes.
All right. It's played. Is there any sequencing going?
Well, the loop, the drum loop that is transformed, the drum loop is transformed through. Yeah. So that's a sequence. I'm trying to think of any other sequencing in there. No, there isn't. Everything else is played.
Yeah, that seems pretty remarkable. I mean, I think it's just because of how long you've been doing this and the ways you started doing this, that anybody else, a new musician that I heard something like this coming out of, I would just assume the whole thing is sequenced.
Well, you know, what's weird, you bring up that subject. I just realized, I looked around my room the other day and I said, wow, there's not a whole lot of MIDI instruments in here anymore. I mean, I've got like 5 Hammonds in here and my Farfisa and a Vox Continental and, you know, various string machines and stuff like that. But I've kind of come full circle back to the 60s in a way. I mean, I do have MIDI instruments, obviously, and I'm using plugins. But it's curious how things change through your changes of life and whatever. I actually prefer to play the instruments direct because of that kind of randomness, even though it's subtle, but I think that all these things add up. In other words, all the performances add up into something that's very real.
Toward the end of the song, you have this chromatic thing that goes up. This kind of signals the end of the song. You break out of the nice tonality for just a second and have this walk up that's through the flatted fifth. And that happens once, and then it rolls through another 8 bars, and it happens one more. And that's kind of the signal that the song is going to end. The song is about to shut down. The wheels are breaking off the side.
It's going chromatic.
Yes. Any other comments on this in terms of how this relates to what you do the rest of the time? I mean, I know most of your time is taken up by producing other artists, but you also, I've seen on your Facebook page, you're getting out and you're playing live, you're producing original material. So what's your balance now?
Well, there's more live than there has been in decades lately, and I'm really enjoying that a lot. And let's see, what else is going on? I'm writing and I am producing. I would say it's pretty much equally balanced. I am not doing a lot of large orchestrations. I did orchestrations mainly with Tori, but with some other people from 2009 to 2013. I must have done like 250 arrangements for large orchestra, octets, quartets, you name it. And that was a great period of time. But it's kind of like when I got back from London from the musical that I did with Tori, I kind of said, wow, okay, I did that. And now what's the next move? Because it was a very intense period emotionally and also in terms of just the intensity of the concentration and everything, which I loved. It's a dream for me because of my classical background. I felt very satisfied. But then, you know, now we need something else. So the rock and roll thing came back again. And I think that's where the live performance stuff and working on Sons of Anarchy with my friend Bob Thiel, we created a band. We did some touring in the United States. We did a lot of the music for that series, played on it at least. I wrote a couple of pieces for it also. But that kind of got me going, and it sparked my interest. That's part of my life again, too.
Let's move to the second song, which is The Stars That Speak by Willie DeVille, you had recommended. So this is an example of something that... So he just came to you. Was he just with the poem, or did he have the main guitar riff?
That song started almost on one of the first records. This song was eventually in the fourth record that I did with him. But I'd heard this piece early on. It wasn't fully flushed out, and it, you know, went back on in the archives. And then when he split from East West back in early 2000s, we started going over material to do, and he played me bits and pieces of this. You know, he didn't have the full music together, but he had a couple of ideas, and he had a melody on the slide guitar, which ultimately ends up in it. And so we did these demos, which we thought were demos, at the Mayflower. I went to New York, and we recorded them at the Mayflower Hotel, which sadly doesn't exist anymore. But it was a beautiful recording, and he felt very at ease, maybe the most at ease I'd seen him in a long time. This was probably 2001, something like that. So I had that. I had his guitar, I had his vocal, and his lyric. And then I proceeded to edit that, create a, you know, a structure around it, and then that's ultimately what became this, The Stars That Speak.
So then you added the actual strings and all that stuff after the fact that was all put together.
Right, after that, and I moved a bunch of stuff around, and pretty much everything was up for grabs. I had to edit the vocal only in the sense that it needed to be strung together in a semi-rhythmic way, because there is kind of a pulse to it. So there was some manipulation that was done.
I mean, there's the footsteps, that's the pulse that goes through the whole thing.
Sure, but I mean, I was thinking in terms of his rhythm.
Vocal.
There's kind of a timing bit that needed a bit of adjustment. But yeah, I like the steps because the steps are semi-random, but not random. I mean, there is a pulse that's set up that's very natural from the steps, and it matches the lyric rhythm also. So it's great.
All right, let's hear it. It was finished in 2008 from the Pistola album.
There's a park somewhere, maybe in New York, maybe in Berry, maybe in Barcelona. Early in the morning, there is the artist, the creator, with a small black beret, a cane, and a small black dog. In the twilight of his life, sees his work, and he feels. Thank you. the stars and praise. I would do anything to be a real woman, of flesh, of love, and of that life I long for so. So the stars give her the night, warning her, do not touch, or they'll die.
It seems like this is sort of similar to the last song in that it's got this pretty basic, it's got a nice little groove that it starts you on, that it feels like it could just keep doing that forever. This dun 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 dun. And then, so, okay, how is it going to actually move? Well, okay, every once in a while it bursts into this Spanish chorus, which you were saying, so those two elements were in the song as Willie presented it to you along with the...
Right, single, in fact, that's Willie. With some additions, Willie plays that basic figure.
Mm-hmm.
Dun, 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 that, and he plays the breakout, but it's also reorchestrated. So I added instruments to that, cymbalum, a frame piano that I play with mallets, the strings, the pizzicato strings, all that stuff was added later.
Which it so connotes the da 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 da. Like I expect a whole Cubano Desi Arnaz orchestra to come out for that.
That's one of Willie's fetishes, is Cuban music and South American music and folklorico and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it was funny. I was reading a little about him. I only introduced to him a few years ago, and probably it was through something on NPR reflecting on his life, but that he was born in Connecticut and he's a New York guy, but that sort of didn't find his musical home until he went to New Orleans after, you know, a bunch of these albums with the group Mick DeVille in New York City, that they were even this CBGB's house band for a while. The other bands of that sort being Talking Heads and Blondie and the Ramones. But he didn't stylistically.
A crazy moment in time. I mean, his band was so different from the other guys, but he was embraced by those crowds, the kind of the punk progressive element.
All right. So then he goes, is it the early 90s to
Europe? Well, he was very popular in Europe, but yes, he went to New Orleans and he did one record, Victory Mixture, I think is what the record was. I didn't produce that.
With Dr. John and some other folks. Okay.
Sure.
And then you got involved with him and developed this great partnership that lasted four albums, yeah. Right? Or three and a half or whatever.
Four. Well, yeah, because three songs on the first record, Dr. John produced two and Philippe Rawls produced one.
I was listening to this whole thing like, oh, this is one of the last things he recorded, and he sounds almost like Leonard Cohen in his, but no, you're saying, no, this is actually one of the first things. This is from nearly a decade earlier.
It's from a decade earlier. And the interesting part about that song is I fought like hell to get that on a record. And I think he might have felt really exposed by doing the narrative, but he eventually got it. He understood what it was about. I think it represents his most exposed place as the artist observing the art form, you know, as the artist is walking. I mean, it really is kind of Willie. You can see Willie walking, you know, with his top hat and his tails through early 20th century Paris. It's pretty classic for him. But he is a fusion of many different styles. That's why there's a certain amount of a Latin element to it. There's a Euro element to it. His music has always been that. He's always experimented with mixing things. And I think that that's why American audiences had a hard time with him, because in a way, you could review him as being like American Schlager, which is German pop music, which basically is a pastiche of many kinds of music all wrapped into one, and usually not the best music. In Willie's case, he fused these pieces together through love, not through commerce. And he really lived it, and I think that it makes it true. He was able to fuse jazz with L.A. Latino sounds, with New Orleans sounds, doo-wop, and that's a combination that is based on American music, but it might be more appealing to a European crowd than an American crowd.
When it gets to the end of the song, it's this "my creation" over and over again. He's pronouncing it "creation," like he's doing it's a Creole thing suddenly. It's a...
Exactly.
Definitely playing with it. Yeah, no, and such an authentic, you know, the little laughs in there. And it would be hard to deliberately do that. I recall just trying to record something like, okay, we've got a walking bass solo in this part of the song. We need something to fill it out. Hey, let's all just kind of make some crowd noises. Do whoops and holler. Like, no, it sounded like the lamest party in the world. It's very hard to...
Oh, totally. Yeah, no, that's what was so inspiring about Willie, because he assumed the role of this. I mean, when he sang, there were times when I first worked with him, we would go in and we'd do a vocal on a particular song and he'd sing it one way. And then he'd say, wait a minute, I've got an idea. Let's do that again. I'm going to try something different. And he said, I'll tell you when I'm ready. So we'd sit there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes waiting, and it's okay, I'm ready. And there was no window at this particular place we were working. I swear to God, I thought somebody else walked in the room and started singing. Uh-huh. I mean, his ability to transform himself was ridiculous. It was amazing that he could do that. He's done it on a number of songs where you say, this is a totally different personality, especially on this last record, the other song, the one about New Orleans. That's another one like that, where he really assumes the identity. And I think that that's what the audience has loved. Live, I think he did assume these personalities that his audiences love, because he was authentic to them.
So then we got this authenticity here, and now we want to orchestrate over it and make it sound so it's artificial, as much artifice as we can put. No, but
yeah, but that's, but in a way that reflects part of his style too, because he is over the top.
Well, it's constructing the stage, the scenery that right. You've constructed. I mean, between this thunder at the beginning or something.
Right.
So where do the steps come into the process? Was this an early on in terms of the arrangement?
Yes. The steps came in almost at the very beginning.
Okay.
Because it just seemed that we had to paint this picture here, this moving picture. It was a good experiment and it worked.
And then we've got the basic string part, which is also just the stepping eighth notes. Da, 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 da. And this, so is it upright bass? This thing that's going boom, 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 boom. Like I couldn't really tell whether this was an electric or an upright or what was doing the bass in here.
It is an upright.
Okay.
And that's why it has such a strong bass. That fundamental is really powerful on an acoustic bass.
Well, and is there timpani also on top of it, in parts of it, that it sounds like...
Oh, yes. Okay. Oh, absolutely.
All right. It sounds like you've got, maybe you had a whole rhythm, you know, there's snare and stuff that had them play through the whole song, but then just mixed them in very slowly
right. So
that you only actually hear them. And it's still pretty damn far away. Like, it's really cinematic in that way. It doesn't...
It is. It's actually taking off on orchestral percussion.
Yes. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Is
right.
Put the percussion over in the back corner. You got the strings outnumber them.
You know, and some people would say maybe the drummer should be in the back corner, but that's an acoustic issue. I don't...
When you do a string section like this, how many players are you talking about? How do you make this sound around?
This was a combination of really good samples and a quartet doubled.
Okay. You've got the basic part, which is the eighth notes, and then you've got in the choruses, you've got this higher violin part coming in. So is that all at the same time, or was it, okay, let's do the eighth note thing all the way through, and that's the one part, and then we'll, just like you would have done on the first song, oh, let's just overdub something. In other words, have the strings play something else. Or was this was all just written out and arranged for them, pretty much?
No, it was written out and arranged. And most of this arrangement came once I decided to orchestrate it, which was early on. I mean, shortly after I got back from the Mayflower sessions, I orchestrated it almost immediately.
When you do this, do you play the parts on keyboard first to kind of get them down and then bother to write it down? Or is it pretty direct?
Well, both things. What I usually do is I at least make a mock-up in the computer, mm-hmm. at least, because everybody wants to hear what something is going to sound like.
Before they put out the money for the string players.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. And also, there were a couple of times where things needed to be changed in a session with a room filled with 40 string players because of whatever, a misunderstanding. And I take care of all the B inserts, take care of it all before the session, because it just takes time and it's so expensive. I mean, if there's an alternative, you even write it down. I'll write down a secondary part that is a possibility just for the sake that it's written. It's on the paper. Everybody can read it. And it saves time because to have the copyist copying while you're sitting there and everybody's going, you know, whistling and waiting for the, you know, to get off break or whatever, you know, it's just not cost effective. So it's best to think of all these things in advance, hence the mock-up, hence alternatives, all that stuff. So basically, I laid it out on the keyboard. Willie approved the arrangement. And then I wrote out the string parts that would be played by the live players.
So it sounds like if you've got all this stuff written out and you've got the session guys in there, would you just, on some of these orchestrations, go ahead and record two versions of something so you can kind of decide after the fact, do you want that riff there or not?
Yes, if that was the case, well, let me see. Certainly you can edit. But the problem with working with a quartet or any multiple strings that you're recording into a stereo pair or even ISO'd, even if you had a stereo pair plus six individual mics, if you make changes on one thing, you're going to hear the leakage from the other thing. So it really has to be definitively recorded as to what it's going to be melodically and part-wise. Now, its position is a different story. Things, of course, now we can move stuff around as much as you want. I mean, you can, for all intents and purposes, you can change the pitch of stuff. But even with a quartet, because you have four tracks and possibly six or even eight tracks of microphones that need to be correlated, it becomes much more difficult to process that.
It sounds like you'd always want to record the strings or the orchestra together because that's what they're used to. And they can be that you never just, okay, cello guy, put your part down and then take it to the violin. Like, which is, if I do strings, that's how I do it because I'm playing half of them myself or, you know, whatever.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think that's a valid thing. That's a very particular sound. It's tight. It's a bit unnatural, but I can see how that could be used for a particular kind of song. That's all good. I'm not saying that you can't do the individual instruments, but players want to hear other players. They want to hear what the other people are doing. The intonation is helped by that.
Sure.
And also an interesting thing that I actually learned, you know, fairly recently is that they really want to hear slap from the walls. They really want to hear the ambience. And it makes total sense because they want to hear the mix coming back to them in a way in the room, which is, you can see that because many string players only use one side of their cans. They want to hear their instrument. They want to hear the room in the other ear, but they also want to hear the track in the other ear. So everybody playing together, that's kind of a way to do it, definitely.
So something I noticed in this arrangement only this morning after sitting down and kind of going it through section by section, after the third chorus, you have vibes come in. Where were the vibes hiding this whole time? Was that an overdub or was that also just part of the orchestra that you were doing live?
Those vibes are from my Chamberlain samples.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. One thing about the Chamberlain and the Mellotron, more so about my Chamberlain because it's so messed up. It's got a very old world, old recording vibe to it. It has tape wobble.
It's kind of like the Mellotron in that it's like an old timey sampler.
Right. And the one that I own in particular is really messed up. So it really has vibe to it. I mean, fortunately, it's not messed up enough that it's unusable, but I mean, it has a certain quality to it. So I find that that's really good because that creates time cues. In other words, you put these sounds in, and it specifies time. like these sounds for me remind me of the 20s and 30s and 40s, you know, because of the tape sound and the scratchiness and the, maybe that's not the case for an 18-year-old right now, but certainly people who've seen movies, even black and white movies or old films and all that, it's kind of a universal evocative sound set. So that's why I like the Mellotron and Chamberlain, also for the fact that it's just a different sound, but it also has a very specific classic evocative nature to them. And in this case was essential. The vibes, the cello, the Mellotron and all that stuff, the Chamberlain, the cello in the beginning, all these things contribute to the time stamp, so to speak.
Well, and the main riff in the chorus that you then overdub with sort of more guitar slide stuff.
Right.
I mean, that's the place where I would hear, if it was going full on Cuban, you'd have the horn section come in there. Was it that you just didn't want to overwhelm things or get too...
Well, I mean, some people call it taste. You know, it could be called taste, or it could be called just... Nah, I don't know. Not feeling that at that particular moment. But we have done things that are like that. I mean, Willie has gone there. But this seemed to be much more evocative of Paris and this smell of a damp street. And that was the balancing knob. I think the knob was shifted a little bit more to the French than the Cuban quarter in Paris. And part of that sound in the chorus you're hearing his slide. You're hearing my kind of slidey sample of guitar. And you're hearing a frame piano, a mallet piano. I have a piano frame that I play, you know, with strings.
It's like an open piano that you're whacking parts of it with it. Oh, all right.
I play it with mallets that you use, players will use on their snares and stuff. Not timpani mallets. They're a little bit too soft. These are a little bit smaller and harder. And I mute the notes that I don't want because there's no mechanism. So there's no way to...
It's like auto harp, pretty much. You're playing an auto harp.
Yeah. So I'm cheating and I'm putting mutes in and around the notes that I'm playing. So you get the resonance of other strings, which is cool. You're hearing the note and you're hearing the string that's maybe an octave away from that string. Mm-hmm. Because the fundamentals are being picked up by the rest of the frame. But in the immediate area of the melody, I kind of keep it cool because I don't want other accidental hits or, you know, it makes it very accurate. That's one of the main sounds in that section that opens up. So it's kind of like a cymbalum without the repeats. An ancient or Hungarian instrument of some sort, you know, that, I don't know. It's one of those evocative things that create another cinema moment.
Well, it's good to get this contrast out with the first song because as a keyboard guy, you're in touch with whatever the latest keyboard technology is. And the fact that you're creating something that is so old world feeling that even though you're using samples and things in it, it does not sound like that a bit.
I like that. That's a good, thank you.
And a good contrast with our third song from 1990, the best synth years there were. I don't know. It's when synth sounds were getting more elaborate and kind of more natural, and you could have stuff like Peter Gabriel, but you also had a lot of things that were quickly deemed very dated with the just changes in, well, you played on the played with Jane's Addiction right after that, so you know we were very able to follow what that was just a year or two after the Royal Macadamians. So this is looks like a super group. It looks like you're all, I was looking up the other guys in here, John Beverly Jones, David Sigerson, Bob Thiel Jr., and they're all just listed as producers.
Yeah, that was a problem. No, I'm only
But so what was the origin? This is kind of a somewhere between, I was thinking Yellow and the Yellow Jackets, to bring out two 80s names from there. That it's got the fusion thing. It has this spot on Miles Davis-y muted trumpet. But then it's also got the almost the ooh bow bow like thing that is the famous song by Yellow from 1985. But it's different sounds, some samples here for the percussion.
I think we were pretty much fearless. I mean, either that or we just could not be embarrassed easily. Something between fearlessness and, you know, silliness, I guess. The four of us worked together a lot in that period of time. We'd worked on the Bangles. We'd worked on Ernie Isley. And David and David, who was kind of the proto-alt band in the late 80s. And we'd spent a lot of time together. And so this was like Christmas, the year before that record was released. And we decided to just spend a month making music that we felt like making and laughing every minute. So basically, we spent a month doing this record based on whim and based on the concept of things that we liked and things that were horrifically commercial and trendy, and we still liked them. There was a band on Globe Style Records. They were doing like a world beat thing that was kind of very humorous.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember their name. But anyways, that was one of the influences in the sense of, wait a minute, we can be humorous. But in our case, we were world beat, but we included a lot of American music in it. But, you know, we were also influenced by Umm Kulthum and the Egyptian cinema and Brazilian music. So there was, we just put it in how we felt like it would be in. I mean, there was a lot of tape editing at this time. There was no Pro Tools. Bev Jones, the engineer, was an amazing cutter. I mean, basically, I would come in the morning, I would either pull out something that I'd been working on, or I'd write it. I think Miles sounding late 60s jazz fusion or jazz progressive piece was done, wait a minute, that's Porno Kiss.
Yes.
Right. That was basically, an idea was sticking around for a couple of weeks. I just started riffing on it, and then I brought it to the band and filled out a little more, and everybody said, yeah, let's work on that. And David worked on the lyrics.
Such as they are. I just wrote down muttering in French. I didn't know there were actual lyrics in this song.
Oh, no, that lyric is in French. And that's David saying he's taking the character of a taxi cab driver in Paris, and he's looking around. It's late at night, and he's looking around to the woman of the streets that's sitting in the cab. And he says, we both work late at night, don't we? That's a bad translation. And that apparently, I think, is from a film, but I don't know which film.
All right. So just before we play it, we've kept people in a lot of suspense here. So I just want to point, so this is just a year or two after it was David that wrote The Eternal Flame. Was that David one of the writers?
David produced that record.
So a number one record that you did the keyboards and strings for and David produced for the Bangles, Eternal Flame, people can look it up. It's sort of the most mainstream thing you could possibly. It's so nice. It's a Beatles-y, but it's all synthy, and it really sounds like 1988 or whenever it was that it came out. And this is right after that. I love the contrast there.
La nuit. Thank you.
as the drum bed here, you've got your synth bass and drum, but then it's kind of punctuated with these screechings on the upbeat. I was playing this with my daughter in the car and she's like, I don't like the screeching that happens at the four of every couple measures. You were saying that you were working on this part and then brought it into the group. What constitutes the core of the song that you brought in? Is it this bass line with the rhythm thing built around it?
Yeah, it was basically the combo section that you heard, the bass, the drums, the Rhodes, and the trumpet. So that was brought in. And in fact, I think it was brought in its entirety.
Which is not real trumpet, right? This is synth trumpet?
No, no, it's actually a Kurzweil 250, which actually had a really good muted trumpet sound.
That's,
on it.
Yeah, it's pretty damn on. This could have been a late Miles Davis tune, as far as I'm concerned. You know, what he was doing in 1988 before he died there.
I guess so. There's some Bitches Brew kind of...
Oh, definitely. The electric piano.
Yeah, the piano was from that, definitely. So in a way, it was an experiment and it was something that I just felt like writing, and Davitt caught it. Davitt was able to take it to the next space. It's interesting because when you think about that, it could be also in a French film, because if you remember, there was a lot of fusion going on in French films in the late 60s, early 70s. There was a lot of progressive music going on. And in a way, it could have been. A lot of jazz guys from America were coming over to France to not only work, but also work in film, do scoring. So there is a connection there.
Now, which of these guys are you still doing the, is it Bob Thiel that you're doing the Sons of Anarchy stuff with?
Yes.
So is he doing the guitars on this?
Yes.
Okay.
He is. Him and I think David Ricketts contribute some. Bob was the main guitar player for most of the music on the record.
All right. I could easily see this as something that a single individual, you know, is just doing basically what you did on the Crossing the Channel and building all this stuff on. It's harder for me to imagine how one collaborates on something like this, but I see, okay, well, let's have everything stop and then have the little rhythm guitar thing come in, that you've got a few things like that that break from the...
Well, that's interesting, because in those days, pre-Pro Tools, it was done through making individual mixes for each part.
Mm.
So what would happen is we would play a section, but we would mute such and such. You know, we would mute everything except the guitar. Mm-hmm. And that's why Bev is a writer on this, because, I mean, his contribution to it, you know, the engineer, was incredible. I mean, his editing capabilities are really phenomenal. So he's really responsible for putting these pieces together.
Yeah. So, I mean, how would you even keep it on rhythm if you're doing this? Like, this is in a part where you could have sequenced the whole thing very easily. And I assume the bass and things, there was some sequence that was running through the song. Okay.
Oh, there was sequencing going on and there was timing. So there was a solid click. So he was able to work off of that.
Okay.
The 24 track, there would be a click. But he had like echoes trailing into the next section. I mean, it was all hand done. It was on a Soundcraft 6000 that I had. Well, that I have, but it's in the corner of my studio. And, you know, he would mute things. And thinking ahead, making sure that the overlap of the effects would overlap into the next section that was completely barren of music, except for like that weird organ that's played, the Nina Rota section in there.
So you'd have to do a whole pass of just, okay, I want a reverb that's going to extend from one section to the other. I'm going to have to solo out that track and just record reverb and then make that a different...
Mute just in time so the reverb continues, but the instrument stop.
Gotcha.
And you get that slice of tape, and then he'd edit that. And, oh, it was marvelous to watch. A craftsman, definitely.
Well, I hope his skills transmitted to the new format and he was not merely... overqualified for digital work.
Yeah. Now that's a good question. Because about five, six years later, he started his own business that involved Avid and video and all that stuff. So I think the audio was still there. He was probably using Pro Tools, but this was much more lucrative for him. I mean, I really congratulate the people who saw the writing on the wall. I mean, for studio, because he owned a studio and all that. And, it's tough. It was tough in the 90s as it transferred into the 2000s. It was a tough time. A lot of studios closed.
I took a class at the University of Michigan in 1992 in electronic music. And what that meant at the time was still giant reel-to-reel tapes with like a thing that would generate a sine wave. Like, it was really learning these basic things and slicing tape together. I never had to do any of that after that moment. You know, within 2 years, I was working on a Mac, But
who knew? I mean, that is now would be considered an art artistic approach.
That's exactly, they were kind of encouraging us. It wasn't you know, there was no question of there being a click track involved. It was a matter of you're taking these pieces of tape and doing interesting things with them and slicing them together and making a contemporary classical piece, not something commercial, something that would actually have a groove.
I love the music concrete stuff from the 50s when the tape machines were first started. You know, they were creating noise blasts through, you know, slanty edits and, you know, oblique edits and all kinds of crazy stuff.
There was some like a 3-disc set of early electronic music that I picked up at some point. It was good once. It's again more you admire the innovation rather than enjoy the sounds that were created.
We come back to that concept of what's music and what's going to stimulate you to make music or stimulate your mind.
Tonally, what's interesting about this whole thing is you're locked into this single key by the bass line, but that you manage through the various Miles Davis-y tricks. What kind of instrument you were referring to? Your keyboard, your da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That brings a whole different major key thing in that wasn't in there before, but yet the bass is still going, doing what it was doing.
Right.
Well, except when, you know, at the place where everything drops out and it's just that.
Sure. Well, yeah, when it goes into the guitar, a woman screaming, knife sharpening, there's some weird allusions in there that is even upsetting to me.
Is that what the scrape is supposed to be? Is knife sharpening the whole time in the percussion?
It's been called that.
Ah. That would make sense.
It's all coming together, I guess. It's weird. But the thing about it is that period of time, and that song is representative of it, it was definitely a free-thinking period. And I think that all of us contributed really equally to this event. It was a social gathering that created music. I'll never forget that. It was very unique.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that this was like a cool vacation sort of thing between producer types doing this rather than I had been doing string parts for all these bands. And now I finally wanted to go out and be a star myself. And this was the thing. Oh, and now it's out of print. And now,
Oh, far from it. This was put on cassette as a Christmas gift to all the people that we worked with, our friends and all that. So we sent it out. David's friend, one of the friends that got it was Chris Blackwell from Island Music. And he heard it and he would play it at parties and stuff. Apparently, this is what I got back from David. And people would kept saying, turn that shit off. And so it happened finally that Chris said, okay, we got to sign these guys. So that's the rumor as to how we got our deal.
All right.
We basically annoyed people enough that Chris thought it was cool. So
have there been any resurgences of this group or similar?
Well, what's interesting is that not this song, but Arbeit macht frei and Relax in Lebanon show up when there is social unrest in like European stations will play it as I'm gathering because I see it on my BMI statements, that, you know, like, I remember back in the 2000s or in the even in the 90s, there was like problems in Syria or the Middle East. I forgot which event happened, but all of a sudden we would see the songs being played, you know, on TV, which the implication being it would be a newscast of some sort. So that's the only indication that anybody is listening to the record at all. And sometimes I see it up on eBay, but that's more of a sign that somebody wants to sell it.
I was more thinking, has this group done anything since then? These particular, I know you've got the Sons of Anarchy partnership.
Well, no, David is still kind of in the music thing. You know, he eventually became president of Polydor and went on to, he was the president of Island for a short time also.
Well, I see his discography, discogs.com thing says he's an American novelist whose first career was in the music business.
Yeah, he's transcended everything. And Bev, I'm not sure what he's doing. Bob and I still work. And most of the other people on the record, you know.
Steve Stevens, I saw you had written down there.
Fabulous drummer and singer.
Not on this song, I guess.
No, he's on Baby.
Okay.
But yeah, so everybody pretty much is still slugging away. We thought about forming a live performance of it. We were going to play in L.A. at some Moroccan restaurants, and that didn't happen.
All right.
We got too busy with our lives.
Getting into the last thing that we're going to leave people with. So tell us about this new project that you've been working on. So the song is Gautama in Love. You were saying this is from an upcoming album a world music album. Is this just something you're doing entirely by yourself, or?
It's entirely by myself, except with some guest spots coming in.
Playing the nay flute and things like that with the world music-y stuff that...
Maybe, but when I say world music, I mean, in a way, a bit like the Macadamians in the sense that it's transformed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to get a reiteration of folklore, it's to, an extended version, extending the resources of a particular style. As in this case, in Gautama, you do have an Indian-flavored rhythm section, but you have hurdy-gurdy playing the lead.
Well, it's hurdy-gurdy. It still suggests India. It's interesting that that's not...
Right. Yeah, because of the bends and stuff. And those bends are a little extreme because I'm working off of a sample. But by the time my live performance comes in, I will have a real hurdy-gurdy to play. So.
Nice.
With effects. But in general, I'm going to be going to Berlin the middle of this year. I hope to record one of my friends who lives there, a guitar player who's really outrageous, André Herbert. He's going to put some guitar down on some tracks. It's taken a bit of time. I started this project about 2 years ago, but there's the beginnings of about five songs.
Well, I've gradually, in the internet age, come to stop considering my not finished albums as not yet finished albums, but as albums that are being released in phases. So you could say, this song is released. You got one. It doesn't have to be the final mix. Maybe you'll fiddle with it more, but it's at least you got something there.
This is, seems to be a good idea. I'm with you on that. Definitely. I mean, that was Addie's and my concept. I mean, we were going to release multiple EPs, and that's still on the books. There's a song that she's working on right now. We've got another song complete. So the next four or five tracks should be available on that EP, hopefully by the end of this year. And Sean Coryell, the A&R person, record company owner that I've worked with over the last couple of years, he has a concept also, which says that basically the idea is that music is never... a particular piece of music can continue to change over time. There can be reiterations of it, reinterpreted. They used to call it remixing, but I think, you know, his concept is beyond that. It's beyond a remix. It's a reformation. And I find that is just intriguing and beautiful because, I mean, how many times has a person put out a record, all 12 tracks, and by the end of the 6 months to a year, let's say it's like normal people who record a record in a normal period of time, if there is such a thing, their state of mind has changed. And then they have to tour with this record and they have to promote this record. I mean, this is kind of a classic concept.
Sure.
I mean, it can be modified, but of course you're touring with a record and you have to sing about you broke up with this girl for the next 6 months or whatever.
Or 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah, for 20 years because it becomes a hit or whatever. You know, God forbid that should be the case. But what I'm saying, it is a time capsule in a way, and it would be great if the time capsule could actually be opened and modified. And the idea of a constant stream of music instead of a pre-described package of music, I used to be against that. I mean, I used to think that, oh, an album is a concept and it's like a book with chapters and all that. But there's no reason why the book can't be read a chapter per month or per 6 months. I mean... You know, sometimes we read books slowly. So this time release kind of concept, I think I've been won over. I think it's definitely a good idea. And also it represents the state of what you're in. You work on a song, you finish a song. This is the state that you were in that particular moment. So however we can deliver this, I think, is a good thing. However we can deliver this concept to our audiences is a good idea.
Before we just play the track and say goodbye, do you want to set it up? You seem to always have these cinematic visions in your head for the different songs. Why Gautama in Love? Is it from the history of the Buddha when he was, is it like the Passion of the Christ?
I've done my fair share of reading of Buddhism and both direct and through writers like Jonghyeom Trungpa and people like that who are modernist visionaries. And the thing about Buddhism is it is a less strict philosophy than other religions. And the thing about Gautama in love is that he was in love. The history is that he was in love and he couldn't continue that. He went on to become an aesthete and a, you know, religious leader, mm-hmm. teacher, and he gave it up. But the thing is, that doesn't mean that that is necessarily the option. I mean, that's not the only option. In other words, he could have just as easily not done that. Whereas in Christianity, it tends to be rule-based, and in most religions. In reality, Buddhism, even though it's interpreted that he made this decision and he sacrificed, Buddhism is a lot more complicated than that because it represents the humanity, and humanity is complicated, and our emotions are complicated, and it's neither black nor white. There's always divisions and blendings of morality and whether things are good or bad. Sometimes it takes a while to understand what it is. So this song kind of represents the man who is destined to be a teacher and is in love. I mean, basically, it's the combination of the two dialogues of this mantra, which I've always been a fan of mantras and drone music and and folk music from around the world. There's a unity there. This drone that happens, and the drone fights against the drone in this improvisational section. So I guess in a way, there's this bipolarity in the song that represents both a mantra groove thing and this wanting to get out thing.
All right, so the song is about drone warfare. We've established that.
Yes.
All right, okay. Thanks so much for doing this, Phil. Really appreciate having you on.
Oh, thank you so much, Mark. It was absolutely a pleasure.
All right. So this is what this podcast is really supposed to be about. I think Phil was about the best possible guest I could have had. A guy really willing to delve into the details of how he arranges things, of his equipment, of the mindset that goes into the choices he makes. After the conversation you've just heard, he shared more of his experiences with me as string arranger for Tori Amos, with the Beach Boys. So if you want to hear us talk about that and the state of the music industry, some more songs, go to nakedlyexaminedmusic.com and look for the link for a recurring donation to support this podcast, to support the many products that the Partially Examined Life Podcast Network puts out. And you can access bonus audio. Now, if you look on nakedlyexaminedmusic.com for the blog post for this episode, I've provided links to more information about Phil and his many, many projects. And I hope you follow up and check out his work. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you're not subscribed to the podcast, please go to the iTunes store or straight to nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. We got some very exciting guests coming up in future weeks. Hope you stick with us and please help spread the word by posting the link to the podcast to your various social media platforms. Keep on being musical. This is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.